You're listening to the Fresh Hell Podcast. Fresh Hell contains stories of a disturbing and often graphic nature and is intended for a mature audience. Please don't let your kids listen to this, or they might turn out like us.
Hi, I'm Annie in the US.
And I'm Johanna from Austria, and you're listening to your favorite international podcast.
The podcast hosted by two women from different continents who have never met in real life but have very, very similar interests in all things murder, mystery, and the macabre. And we like our crime old, just like us. If you listen to the last episode about the wonderful dog stories, you might remember that Johanna said that we needed a palate cleanser episode because the previous three episodes and because the next episodes are going to be very upsetting as well.
Yeah. Oh, before I forget it, my husband reminded me of something I completely forgot to mention in the previous episode. A while ago, I had read an article to him that stated that dogs actually changed their facial muscles to be able to communicate better with humans. So unlike wolves, dogs develop muscles around their eyes and mouth that allows them to change their expression faster and imitate human facial expressions, especially the ability to imitate a baby-like expression. I think everyone who has a dog knows exactly what I mean. You know, the huge eyes and the cute face they make when they want something. Think Puss in Boots from Shrek. I can't believe I completely forgot to mention that extremely interesting fact.
It's such a good fact.
Isn't it?
Yeah.
Fascinating, right?
We used to call it puppy face with Tucker. We were like, oh, puppy face is out because, oh, big brown baby seal eyes face. How are you going to not give that face some pizza bones, right? He's like, look at me, mother. I am starving. I am withering away on the vine.
They know exactly what they're doing. Growing muscles just to manipulate us.
So smart.
But that's enough from dogs, even though there's never enough.
Never.
Never enough dog. About last week, you might have wondered why there was no new episode last week if you're not on our social media. We made a post on Instagram and Facebook about it, but for those of you who are not on there, initially I had planned to cover a very different case last week, a rather recent one that happened in 2020 in Italy, a case of femicide. And I had finished most of my research and we were almost ready to record when I came across an interview with one of the victim's family members, which I don't know how to
word
it.
They were upset. They were upset about the interviews.
They were upset and it made me feel like
upset.
It was too soon to talk about the case.
Yeah.
And after all, true crime is not here for our entertainment, but, you know, to give a voice to victims and their families. And that reminds me, I just saw a post the other day on Twitter by a fellow podcaster where he said that he had just gotten some feedback. A listener who wrote something about how boring it is when he interviews the family members of victims and, you know, it's just give us the details. We just want to have the details.
Whoa.
Mm.
Oh, you're going to have to fill me in on who that was later.
Yeah. And then another podcaster chimed in and she said that she sees a huge drop in downloads whenever she interviews family members. I think, and I'm sure Annie, you agree with me, that this is absolutely fucked up.
Yeah.
And I honestly predict a bit of change in the next couple of years when it comes to true crime and true crime communities. Because too many people just view it as some form of bizarre popcorn event and we're not here for it.
No. No, not at all. I agree with you. And there are some problematic people out there in the community, but these are real people that we're talking about. The stories that we give you are, except in rare, rare cases where we're discussing urban legends and we make things very clear, you know, we are always telling you the true story of something that has happened to somebody, something that people had to survive. And sometimes you can tell from a lack of interviews in older cases that the family doesn't want the publicity, right? And when we find that, even in a case that happened 100 years ago, we really try to be respectful. That's when we don't give you the huge backstory. You know what I mean? Mm. We just keep it to ourselves because it's not important, really, to the case. And we want to respect people's privacy. But that's not really possible when it's a crime that happened so recently, right? And we mostly cover recent crimes for two reasons. Either it's a huge, huge, huge case that we've had many, many requests to cover. That's the usual. Or it's a lesser-known case that the families of the victims want to be told in order to help spread the word about a missing person. I'm thinking about Lars. Or in order to try and prevent the same thing from happening to someone else, like Lauren Astley, you know. And I'm just really sorry that you found the interview. I'm not sorry that you found the interview. I'm glad you found it, because we always, always want to respect their feelings. That is utmost important. I'm just sorry that you found it at the very end and not on daylight two.
Fine. I mean, better before recording than after we drop an episode.
Oh, absolutely.
And it was really just, it was like a snippet meshed into interviews with other people. But I'm glad I found it and I heard it, because I was like, ooh. I'm not going to cover this case. It's just too soon.
No, we're not trying to make anybody's lives more painful with what we do.
Exactly.
That's not ever our goal. Unfortunately, our listeners, I think, understand that completely. So, and you know, if you don't, there are other podcasts out there. So
definitely.
It's okay.
Now we can step down from
all
the
soapbox.
Yeah. I know that our listeners are good people who don't disregard victims and their loved ones. And yeah, I know you understand that we just won't cover a recent case when the families are not on board with coverage of these cases. And also, we have plenty of mystery and macabre historical episodes that can be used for your pure entertainment.
Oh, I'm working on one right now.
So what are we going to talk about today?
I'm excited.
Well, this is a case where the victim herself has always been very outspoken. It's an Austrian case, a rather infamous one, or famous. I think it's an internationally famous case. Some listeners have asked me to cover it ever since we started with this podcast, because I'm Austrian, this happened in Austria. And it's the abduction of Natascha Kampusch. We will not only be discussing the case itself, but also the aftermath and how the Austrian media and the Austrian public treated the young woman later on. And as a content note, nobody will be murdered, but we will be talking about the abduction of a child, so keep that in mind, please.
This case, I know people have been asking from the beginning for you to cover it, and I feel like I'm one of them. I know the name and the very basic facts, and that's it. So I'm really looking forward to this one.
Sources for this episode are, as always, articles, most of them in German, but also Natascha's own book, 3096 Tage, so 3096 days. As always, we'll link all of our sources in the according album.
That's a lot of days. Jesus.
All right, let's start. So Natascha was born on 17th of February 1988 in Vienna. And at the time of Natascha's birth, her mother, Brigitte, was 38 years old and already had two grown-up daughters from a previous marriage. Brigitte had met Natascha's father, Ludwig, when she was 35 and working as a seamstress. She was a hard worker and managed to put food on the table by sewing and altering clothes for the women in the neighborhood. One of her customers was a woman who ran a bakery with her husband and her son, and so sometimes when she would get clothes altered, she would bring her son with her. You might have already guessed it, this man was Ludwig, Natascha's father-to-be. He was working as a baker in his parents' bakery in a town just at the outskirts of Vienna. He seemed to really fall for Brigitte, and so he started to visit her more frequently, and the two became a couple. 3 years later, their daughter Natascha was born, and the two ran a little corner shop together, and the young family of three lived in one of the apartments in the Rennbahnweg-Siedlung.
Okay, so what's that?
Let me think how best to describe it. First of all, the official name of the buildings is Trabrenngründe, but everybody knows it as Siedlung am Rennbahnweg or Rennbahnweg-Siedlung. It's a housing project. I think Siedlung is best translated with residential subdivision. At the Rennbahnweg, that's a street name in Donaustadt, the 22nd district of Vienna. The apartment blocks were built in the 1970s and they contain a total of 2,424 apartments. And when the Siedlung was built, the surrounding area was not yet developed and consisted mostly of farmland. So they also built shops, a church, a kindergarten, a bunch of other stuff the residents would need. I don't think you have really similar apartment blocks in the US. I could be totally wrong, but I think it's more of a European thing that started after World War II. I sent you a photo. What do you think?
So we also have housing projects, but they're generally more for low-income residents, and that's kind of a complicated and often problematic issue, but these look more like they're creating a small town to support booming populations, because the photo looks like really good size apartment buildings, but they're laid out in like a rectangle, which looks like with what looks like a really nice like park setting on the inside, like a courtyard designed around a courtyard. Is that right?
So a lot of buildings were destroyed during the war. Obviously, Vienna was lucky if you compare it to cities like, for example, Berlin or Hamburg. We talked about the bombing of Hamburg in the episode about the Hamburg rabble murderer. But still, there was some damage. And also, the old apartment houses in the inner city district were mostly substandard. There was often no running water and no toilet inside the apartments. We talked about that in a lot of episodes. They were small and dark and hard to heat. So new apartments were built at the outskirts of Vienna, and the units were new and with modern appliances, big windows that would let the sunshine in, and often a balcony. So it was kind of a utopian dream, you know, architects picturing young families strolling around after work and children playing on the playgrounds, you know, a new modern way of living.
They look nice.
It's so interesting how things constantly change, though. In the 70s, everybody wanted to leave the old buildings, and then just 20 years later, they were what everybody wanted, you know, high ceilings, double wing doors, close to the city center. And nobody wanted to live in Rembrandtweg-Siedlung, for example.
Right.
So around the time when Natasha was a kid, the once modern Rembrandtweg-Siedlung had turned into kind of a social hotspot, because many of the residents were depending on social welfare. They were unemployed and often abusing drugs and alcohol. So it maybe wasn't the lovely dream for young families that they thought it would be. I have to say, though, when it comes to subsidized housing, Vienna did something very right that not too many other cities actually did. In many cities, you have the socially weaker people all living in certain areas, right? Vienna is really one of the few European cities I know where subsidized housing can be found in every single district. Every district consists of a good mix of people with all different social backgrounds. And of course, you have the ultra fancy and rich districts, like the 1st or the 19th, for example. But even there, you find this kind of subsidized housing. And I think that's actually a good thing, and one of the factors that make Vienna a rather safe city. I'm not even sure if subsidized housing is the absolutely right term. It's buildings that were paid for by the municipality. And today, for example, Vienna has over 2,300 of these apartment buildings, with over 220,000 apartments and more than 500,000 people living in them. And we are at almost 1.9 million people in Vienna, so that's a quarter of people living in these kind of apartments.
Yeah. That is good. I think one of the problems with housing projects here is they become a convenient place to put poor people and then say, see, we're helping, but all they're actually doing is concentrating poverty into one area. And then everybody blames the poor and they become scapegoats for the inevitable problems with crime that will follow, right? When you're in an area with just everybody living below the poverty line. The system is really set up to make it almost impossible to break the cycle of poverty here. We're supposed to have affordable housing in every town, but what ends up happening lately is a developer will want to tear down a single-family house and then build, like, an apartment building with 30 apartments. And it won't get approval, because they'll say it's too much population density for one spot, and it's not the right codes for that part of the town. So then they'll come back and say, you know what, we're going to make this affordable housing. And then they'll make like 5 units affordable, and now they have permission. That's their get in. The poor, in the meantime, are still struggling to find any kind of affordable, safe housing. And at the same time, they're exploited for financial gain of others, right? It's just a really serious problem here. And I think you guys handle it a lot better than we do.
I mean, we still have problems, and it's getting worse lately. But yes, compared to other cities, I think Vienna did a great job.
Yeah. That's a whole other, though. We could do a whole episode. I mean, it's not what we do, but just...
It's definitely...
It's such a problem.
Even the history of social housing in Vienna, it's very interesting, but that's a whole different topic. Back to Natasha Kampusch and her story. Okay, so they were living in one of the apartments at Rennbahnweg. By the way, nowadays apparently a great area to live again, so you see how things constantly change. Constantly.
All the time.
And the parents were running a little corner shop. And Natasha's father was a rather extroverted man. He loved company. He loved to be social. He loved going out with his friends and, you know, having a couple of drinks. And that was a bit of the opposite to Natasha's mother, who was a hard worker. I think she had to be. She had been a single mom for a very long time, and she was more of a no-nonsense character. And of course, these two types of people are often attracted to each other. Opposites attract, mm-hmm. after all. But many times these relationships can be very challenging and often fail. And so when Natasha was 5, her parents separated and Natasha stayed with her mother in their apartment. And this was a very difficult time for everyone involved, obviously, and of course, especially for the young girl. Separations are always so traumatic for children involved, and I'm speaking of experience. Unfortunately, often the grown-ups are so caught up in their own pain that they might forget that there's another person involved and that this person is a little kid, for example, who doesn't even have the language yet to talk about the emotions they feel or the coping mechanism that grown-ups have when, you know, their whole life is turned upside down. And in her autobiography, Natasha describes this time as extremely difficult. She felt that she was expected to just be strong and power through it without complaining, without showing how she really felt inside. I think this must have been a very lonely time for the young girl, and she probably felt some disconnect from her parents. One childhood incident she describes I found very interesting. When she was 8 years old, she was on a school outing. I don't know if you have those in elementary school or as young high schoolers. Here it's called Schullandwoche or Skikurs or Sportwoche. Children go on a school trip for a week where they mostly go skiing or hiking or doing some other sport. Do you have those?
Not really for a week. There would be... I'm just trying to think, like, through activities that you did, right? So my chorus took a trip once for a competition mm-hmm. we were in, or because I was in Spanish, I went on a school trip to Spain, but it wasn't a class trip. It was a,
okay.
Do you know what I mean? No, you guys have much more, like, every year, my nephew who is in England has been to, like, France, Morocco. He's been all over the world just on school trips. We don't really do that.
And also it's mostly skiing.
Yeah.
So Natasha went on one of these trips when she was 8 and she was playing with the other kids outside when she fell. And I guess it was from something, from a height, like monkey bars or something similar.
Yeah.
And she was suddenly in a lot of pain, but she didn't dare to cry or tell the teachers how much she was hurt. And it was only the next day that they realized that she had broken her arm.
Would she not have felt comfortable telling the teachers that she was hurt? Was she punished for crying?
I think it was more like she was used to try to not be a burden or to not, you know, complaining about things.
Ah, okay. Gotcha.
So I think it was more like this, that's the kind of thing she was more used to, like staying quiet and, you know.
Yeah.
Just powering through things. When we were kids, we used to play outside, unsupervised, no way to reach your kids. For the parents, because there were no cell phones, you just told your parents who you were going to meet and they told you what time you had to be back home. And that was it. Mm-hmm. And that was totally normal. I'm sure it was the same for you, Annie. From a very early age, my parents had told me to never get into the car of a stranger, to not believe men who tell me that my mommy had an accident and they had been sent to pick me up, not yeah. take the shortcut, you know, these kind of things. Because things happen to children. Children were snatched and murdered.
Yeah.
That always happened. There was never a time in history where that didn't happen, I think.
No, it's always, always happened. And talking about shortcuts made me think of the first case I think you covered on this show, the Bleistift murder, which I'm probably pronouncing wrong still, but that case still gives me chills. My mom made a code word. There was if I can't even remember what it was now, but there was a code word. So if anyone came and said my mom sent them, we had to ask for the code word. I can't remember it now, but Moose might. But yeah, you're absolutely right. This was Stranger Danger times.
And when Natasha was a kid, she's 9 years younger than me, so my sister's generation, more or less. There was a time when a lot of these cases happened in a rather short amount of time in Germany and Austria, or it maybe seemed like a lot because they were all over the news all of a sudden.
No, there were here too. Yeah.
Parents and teachers everywhere told the kids to be careful. And I think also it was around that time, late 90s, when parents started to be a bit less on board with kids, you know, running around outside unsupervised. I think that's when it started, that parents would always take their kids to school or maybe have play dates at home. I think that was late 90s, early 2000s,
totally
right?
Totally agree. Yep. Yep. And I think, you know, like we were saying before, it's always happened. I think what started to, and we'll talk about this more, I think, in a bit, but it just got easier. Communication got easier. So whereas previously you would only hear about the case that happened in your town or in your state, you know, Adam Walsh made headlines around the world. There are so many. There are Molly Bish. I mean, the list is unending and still growing, right, of kids that just go missing.
Also, in all honesty, I don't even want to know how many kids were molested and never told anyone.
Oh, of course. Of course.
You know?
Yeah, of course.
Who just were too scared, too ashamed and just went home and nobody ever knew that something happened to them. I think that happened so often.
Well, that's happening today.
Yeah, true. So on the morning of 2nd of March 1998, 10-year-old Natasha wakes up and she gets ready to go to school. It was a Monday and Natasha had just spent the weekend with her father and he had returned her home a bit too late that Sunday and he also hadn't walked her up to the apartment, which made Natasha's mother furious because she thought it was way too dangerous for a little girl to walk to the apartment building all alone in the dark, which she's not wrong.
No.
And Brigitte apparently was so upset and angry that she told Natasha that she just about had it and this was the last time she had seen her father. I don't think she really meant it, but we all know sometimes you say things when you're really, really mad and you don't really mean it.
Yeah.
But of course, Natasha got very upset and they started to argue and then Brigitte told Natasha to go to bed. So the very next morning, the girl had decided to walk to school alone. I think it was after her 10th birthday, just 2 weeks earlier, that she had asked her mother if she could soon walk to school, because up until then her mother used to drive her, but this day, the first school day in March, was the day that Natasha had chosen to be a big girl and walk the short distance, because what could go wrong? Natasha got dressed, she was wearing a kind of blue-grayish checkered dress, and the top was made out of denim, and it had long sleeves, and with it she wore black shoes and a red jacket. Her school bag was kind of bluish, greenish, turquoise, and she packed her lunch. She patted her cats goodbye and opened the apartment door. She then contemplated telling her mom goodbye, but she was still mad at her, and anyway she would see her after school because what could go wrong? It's a 4-minute drive or a 12-minute walk. A bit longer for a little kid, probably. It's a bit over 1.3 kilometers or 0.8 miles.
Well, yeah. So when I was a kid, when I was her age, the school bus had to drop you within a mile of your house. So that would have been pretty damn close to exactly what my walk home was from the school bus. I would think a child that age would be perfectly fine doing that walk.
Yeah.
I don't think she's taking any crazy risks here.
Yeah. Plus, it's Vienna. It's not like...
It's the middle. It's
somewhere
the morning.
In the countryside where she has to walk through the forest or something.
Yeah,
like
it's
this.
Not 2 a.m. Yeah. It's like people she's on the streets. Walking to school yeah. during the busiest yeah. commute time
people
of the day.
People are going to work.
Yeah.
Kids are going to school.
Totally yeah. safe.
When she made the right turn into Melangasse, just 300 meters or 0.18 miles from her school, she lifted her head and she saw a white van parking a few steps ahead. And next to it was a young, slender man. And Natasha had a weird feeling when she saw the man, but probably thought that she, you know, had to just quickly walk past him and then she was almost at school. But when she was right next to him, she felt the man grabbing her around her waist, lifting her up and throwing her inside the van. And then the door closed and the man got in the driver's seat and they drove off. And then the kidnapper told Natasha that he would now meet up with the others and hand her over and then he would have nothing more to do with the whole thing.
The others?
Yeah, that's what he said. He then drove to a forest where he parked the car and waited. And sometimes he would frantically type some numbers into his phone. Yes, apparently he was one of those people who already had a cell phone in 1998. I think that's here when it was still expensive but already available to average people.
Yeah.
I think my boyfriend at the time got his first cell phone the year before in 1997. And was it the same in the US in the beginning? It was considered bad manner to take your phone out in restaurants and in public spaces, and when you got a call while socializing, you were kind of embarrassed. I'm still like it, I think.
Oh, I am too. I won't take a phone call. I mean, if I have to take a phone call and I'm at a table, then I'll excuse myself. It's rude as fuck to talk on your phone in a restaurant. The worst, though, the absolute worst, like, do not pass go, you're going straight to hell for me, is people with no reason to do it who are talking on speakerphone. In public,
oh, God, yeah.
It's like they are in the 10th circle of hell Dante didn't know about them yet. It's fine. Yeah, I had a cell phone when I was in college in the late 90s, and I really vividly remember it, but it was really just an emergency use only kind of a thing. You know, literally, it was a... I had a mom who was into true crime, so I had an emergency cell phone.
Yeah, smart. Anyhow, the kidnapper was trying to call someone, but nobody answered, and then he exclaimed, "They're not coming." And he started the car and he drove off.
Okay, so there were others, there were people who hired him to take her?
That's an excellent question, and we'll talk more about it next week. And there is still some debate around this whole thing. Were there others involved? I think that there were no others. I think he made them up to scare her, something like a good cop, bad cop kind of thing.
Oh.
I think the evidence points to that. But once we progress, you will hear more things that show you how he tried to manipulate her, so you can form your own opinion on it.
Okay. So, all right. So he, so they leave, the city, and then they leave the forest.
Mm-hmm.
And then where do they go?
They drove to Strasshof, a town northeast of Vienna, and just a 20-minute drive from Natasha's home, actually.
Okay.
Nowadays, Strasshof an der Nordbahn, or Strasshof at the Northern Railway, that's the official name, has a population of almost 11,000, but in 1998, it was just around 6,000. So it almost doubled since then. And it's a rather quiet town with mostly family homes, a railway museum, a Holocaust memorial, because Strasshof was a station on their way to concentration camps for over 20,000 people. And so, lots of family houses, and one of the houses belonged to Natasha's kidnapper, a man named Wolfgang Priklopil. He was born on 14th of May 1962 in Vienna. His father worked for a company that produced liquor, and his mother worked as a clerk, I think. She gave up her career when Wolfgang, their only child, was born. As far as we know, the family was happy and they lived a nice middle-class life, a car, yearly trips to Italy, and then in the 1970s, their own house in Strasshof. That's a pretty good life for the 70s in Austria.
Okay, yeah. That sounds like a pretty good life anywhere, really.
Yeah. And Strasshof is where Wolfgang Priklopil grew up and went to school. He was a good student, but kept mostly to himself. He didn't participate in any group activities. No team sports, he mostly stayed home and studied. He loved to build model airplanes and model trains. He also did puzzles. When he got older in his teenage years, he didn't show any interest in his female classmates. He didn't go to parties or discos. He was interested in modern technology. I think that also shows that he was one of, you know, he already had cell phones
yes.
in the late 90s. And kind of other technology that was available at the time, video cameras, for example.
Giant video cameras. That weighed.
Giant video cameras.
70 pounds.
With video cassette tapes in it.
Yeah.
He also liked fast cars.
I mean, who doesn't?
After school, he started working as a mechanic for Siemens, I think specializing in telecommunication. His co-workers described him as hardworking, polite, diligent, but always a bit aloof, an introvert, and rather quiet, tight-lipped.
That's kind of almost the best kind of co-worker, though, isn't it? Like, they're great.
Sure.
He's hardworking and polite and friendly, but
yeah.
Don't really hear much from him.
I think around the time of Natasha's kidnapping, he had stopped working for Siemens for a time already. We're going to talk a bit more about that later on, I think. As I said before, Wolfgang was an only child and always had a very close relationship to his parents, especially to his mother. This intensified after his father died in 1986. He was admitted to the hospital on suspicion of appendicitis, but it was actually final stage of colon cancer.
Mm.
So that was a really sudden and unexpected death, and after that, Wolfgang and his mother became even closer. She would take care of him around the clock. She would cook and clean for him, do his laundry, prepare his lunch. They would spend the evenings together watching TV, and on weekends, they would drive out to the countryside. You know, these kind of things.
Hmm.
Wolfgang was 24 at the time. I don't want to talk badly about parents having a close relationship with their kids. I think it's wonderful. I know that parents think they are doing the best for their kids when they take care of them and do everything for them. But being a parent also means that you have to teach them to be independent.
Yeah, as independent as they can be. It's true, though, isn't it? Because when you're 16, you're convinced. I was convinced the only reason that my parents wanted children was it so they had someone to take care of the dishes. And as it turns out, we weren't wrong. I think that is one of the absolute top reasons to procreate, is so that someone else will do the dishes. But in all seriousness, you do have to figure out a way to do all of these things so that you can, if possible, live on your own one day and thrive and, you know how to live your life. If we'd had kids, they'd have learned cooking, sewing, home and car maintenance, all genders. Everybody needs to know how to sew and how to, boil an egg and change a tire. But Wolfgang is giving me real psycho vibes. I feel like he calls his mother mother, but like not in a nice way.
Like psycho, like in the movie Psycho, like Norman Bates.
Yes, yeah, like in the Anthony Perkins vibes, yeah.
So at one point, it even gets worse. At one point, Wolfgang's mother moved out of the house and into a little apartment in Vienna.
Oh, that's good.
It's good, you're not going to say that for long. The apartment was in the same district as Natasha's apartment, just an 8-minute car drive from the Rennbahnweg. But even though Wolfgang lived alone now, his mother would still come over and cook and clean for him. She would meal prep for the whole week so that he would only have to heat things up.
Oh.
And that was Wolfgang's life. At least on the surface. Because he had a secret life that nobody knew of or even suspected. He had formed a plan and he had worked on putting this plan into action. He had built a secret chamber underground. In his garage there was a workshop pit. And I know we mentioned workshop pits before, but I really can't remember when or why. Wait, I remember now. When we talked about the Goerde murders.
That's still one of my favorite. Just the Goerde murders. The way horrible. It rolls off the tongue. Well, not off mine, but off yours. Yeah, those are, everybody wants those here. But you have to say they're a fruit cellar because they're illegal because all the stuff sinks.
Yeah. Told me that, and now I remember. Yeah. For those of you who don't know, because I'm not sure they are still a thing people casually have in their homes nowadays, at least not in the more modern homes.
Just all my husband's friends would want. If you're not into cars and motorcycles, if you're just a normal person who hasn't designed their lives around motorsports, yes.
I think nowadays you have more things that lift your car up if you have the space, right?
Yeah, that's why the garage mahal is so tall.
So a workshop pit is something people had in their garage. My grandfather had it, for example. It's a pit in the ground, deep enough for you to stand in and work on your car when you park it over the pit.
Yes, change your own oil.
For example, Wolfgang's pit had stairs that led down to a little room where you could keep your tools and tires. And there was a sideboard, kind of a sideboard. And when you would move that one out of the way, you would find a safe in the wall. And when you pulled that safe out of the wall, you would find a hidden door, rather small and enforced with thick concrete on one side. And that door would lead to another tiny room, and I think there was a fridge in there, we talk about that later. And another door then led to a little cell. And it was tiny. It was 278 times 180 centimeters, or 9 times 6 feet. More or less. In there was a sink, a double sink, and a toilet, and that was it in the beginning. And that's where 10-year-old Natasha found herself after she had been abducted on 2nd of March 1998. And we will post a video, a police video, that shows the little cell and the plan of the setup of the hidden room.
Yeah, we'll be talking about that, I'm sure, in the Facebook group. This is horrifying. This is horrifying.
Did you watch the video?
I did.
So claustrophobic.
Yeah.
Horrible.
Yeah. I'm not even claustrophobic, and it's a no.
After they had arrived in Wolfgang's house in Strasshof, he had parked a van in his garage. He rolled Natasha into a thick blanket and carried her inside the house and ultimately down the steps in the pit and into the hidden room, where he put her on the floor and left her there in the dark. When her kidnapper returned, he brought a light bulb and he asked her what she would need, and she asked for a brush, a toothbrush, and toothpaste. And when he returned with the requested items, plus a mattress, a blanket, and some cookies, Natasha asked him to read her a goodnight story, just like her mommy used to do.
Oh, that's devastating. Poor kid just wants some normalcy, huh?
I think that's exactly it. She's a little kid trying to make sense of what's going on and having, like, a little bit of routine there.
Yeah. That's awful.
Also, maybe a bit of testing the waters, like, if he brings me what I ask for, or if he reads me a story, maybe he's not an evil person.
Mm.
Because after all, she still believes that he had only kidnapped her, only, you know, only. In quotation marks,
yeah.
for other people, and that he was now stuck with her. I think that's also the reason why the cell he kept her in wasn't completely furnished at that point. That's why he brought a mattress and a blanket when she was already there, to make it look as if it hadn't all been planned out, and her being there was not what he had intended.
Oh, right, because if she walked in and saw a bed and everything, then yeah. she would know. That makes sense.
Because I'm sure he had this whole thing planned completely through.
Yeah, there's no way that setup was a spur of the moment.
Yeah. What Natasha didn't know, but for sure suspected, was that her parents were looking for her, and I'm sure it made her feel sad to picture them worrying about her and her not being able to tell them where she was. And yes, of course, when Brigitta realized that Natasha hadn't arrived at school that day, they immediately started looking for her. They had this fight the evening before, and Natasha had left without saying goodbye. Was she still mad? Had she run away? If so, where could she have gone? In the evening, after they couldn't find her anywhere, they contacted the police and they started this huge search. Because even if Natasha had run away, she was a 10-year-old out alone and she was in great danger.
Yeah, that's a problem. No matter what the reason yeah. she's missing, a child that age needs to be found.
We don't have this kind, I know you have Amber Alerts there now, we don't have this kind of alarm system here, unfortunately. I know somebody just asked in the Facebook group a couple of days ago. Yeah, we don't have anything like this, unfortunately. But at least they reacted immediately.
Was this before or after our Amber Alerts? Do you know?
When did your Amber Alerts start? Wasn't it like in the early 90s?
I'm looking
or was
at
it later? I knew the answer to that already.
I know it was Amber Hagerman. I just can't.
Yeah.
Abducted and later found murdered, 1996.
Oh, so that was after Amber.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. But I'm not sure when the... I just looked up when the murder happened, but when did the actual first...
When was the system set up, the Amber Alert system? Yeah, that's a good question.
1998, maybe?
Same year as Natasha went missing.
And then it wasn't until October of 2000 that the United States adopted a resolution encouraging communities around the country to implement the plan. Yeah, it wasn't nationwide until the early 2000s.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So this is saying September 2002, 26 states had it. So it wasn't like we were killing it over here. That's a terrible yeah. choice of words.
But, I mean,
it wasn't like we were handling
it's 20
it
years
better.
Later and we still don't have something like this. But
yeah,
also,
right.
I don't think a lot of kids go missing here. I would have to... I'm going to let you know next week. I have to look
yeah,
it up.
Yeah, it's all right.
Anyway, they used helicopters, they used search dogs, they used volunteers, they searched everywhere. They used posters and flyers, obviously. The missing person posters were everywhere. I remember it so vividly. I was in my last year of high school and I had to take a train to the next city. That's where my school was. Vienna was a 30-minute car drive from where I grew up and it seemed like a completely different world. I barely ever went to Vienna.
Oh, yeah.
I lived south of Vienna, completely opposite side from where Natasha had gone missing. But every train that I used to go to school had the missing person posters on the inside of the doors, like every train. The posters looked like the usual missing person ones, on it a current photo of Natasha with... I'm not even sure if it was the same dress. I think it was the same dress that she wore when she went missing. Or otherwise a very similar one. A description of what she was wearing that morning, and to please contact the police if you had any information. And so yeah, they really, really tried to find her, obviously. And people would call the police all the time. So many tips came in. People were sure they had seen the girl here or there or over there. Of course, none of these were real sightings of Natasha, because she was in a secret room under a house in Strasshof. And of course, people were trying to help, and I'm sure most of them were absolutely convinced that they really saw the missing girl. But the police had to go through all of this, and... I don't mean that you shouldn't call if you think you saw something, not at all. If you think you have a lead or some info in any of the current cases, please always contact the authorities. All I'm trying to say is that it took some time to work through all the tips that came in.
Oh yeah, I can understand that. Lots of tips are, I think, a blessing and a curse for authorities, right? Because there's so much to wade through, but it's not your job to decide if what you know or think you know is relevant. Just tell them, and then let them take it from there, because you never know. If something you think is super insignificant and doesn't make any difference, that could be the final piece That could be the final piece of a puzzle you don't even know is being put together behind the scenes, right? Okay, so there were no leads, no witnesses, nothing. They had nobody saw this happen.
There was a witness.
Oh, good.
So Natasha, as I said before, she had been abducted in broad daylight around 7:20 a.m. on a Monday in Vienna. Someone had seen what had happened. And it was a 12-year-old girl who was on her way to school as well. And she said that around 7:20, she had seen Natasha being pulled into a white van. And she was sure that there had been two men. One in the driver's seat of the van and one outside or inside who had pushed or pulled the little girl. Over the years, she had repeated this testimony several times. And we'll talk about it more next week when we will discuss the aftermath in the case. But this 12-year-old was the only witness of Natasha's abduction. So now the police had a lead, a white van. It's so cliché, right?
Yeah, it really is.
So yeah, they were looking for a white bus that had blacked out windows in the back. But obviously they had no make, no model. The young witness didn't know any details, nor had she looked at the license plate.
No, but at least it's something. They know now that she's not intentionally missing, for example.
Yeah. Exactly.
They don't want to be knocking on her friends' doors to see if she's sleeping in their closets. They have bigger problems now.
Yeah, they know somebody took her. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So now they pull all of the data of owners of white vans in the proximity. I'm not sure if they did it in all of Austria. I think probably just in Vienna, Lower Austria, and, you know, kind of driving distance.
Mm-hmm.
And they start going and ring at doors of the owners of white vans, and they ask if they can take a look at the van. And guess what? One day, only a few weeks after the disappearance of Natasha Kampusch, on 6th of April 1998, they even knock on Wolfgang Brickloppil's door.
No.
Mm-hmm. Because they want to see his white van, a second-generation Mercedes MB100. He had bought the white van in April of 1997 from a used car salesman, and the MB100 was a so-called cab over van, meaning cab over engine, so the driver sits over the engine instead of the engine being in front of the driver. So the police pays Brickloppil a visit. They ask if they can take a look at the van. He says sure. He says that he was expecting a visit because he read in the newspaper that they were looking at white vans. You know, he had read because of the abduction of that little girl. And they look at the van and it's full of tools, and he tells them that he uses it for construction work. That's how he made his money, renovating apartments. And they also ask if he has an alibi for the time of the abduction. And he says no, he was home. The police finds nothing suspicious and they leave, not knowing that the little girl they are looking for is only a couple of feet from them in that little secret cell. And you know who else has no idea that Natasha is in that house? Wolfgang's mother. She keeps coming every week to clean, wash and cook, just like she had done all those years before, and she will continue to do so over the next years.
Years?
Mm-hmm. Years.
Oh boy.
But yeah, more on that next week. On 14th of April 1998, so just 8 days after the police check Brickloppil's van, the police gets another tip. A police officer, I think it was a canine handler, informs the investigators that there is a suspicious man living in Strasshof who drives a white van and is kind of an introvert who gives off weird vibes. And he has never been in a relationship with a woman and he might be interested in children.
Mm.
And the investigators just write a note that they already checked Wolfgang Brickloppil and that they found nothing suspicious, and they cross him off the list of suspects.
Wow. So this for me is the most upsetting thing I've heard so far in terms of the investigation, because it's so hard to believe that an officer saying, hey, mm-hmm. I think you need to look a little bit more closely at this suspect.
At this guy.
Mm-hmm. And they completely dismiss it. That is shocking to me.
It is. It is. And that was their chance, right?
Right.
That could have led to Natasha being found so quickly.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, it didn't happen. Natasha was missing, and she would stay missing for a very long time. And I think this is a very good moment to stop for this week, so we'll talk about everything else next week.
Oh, wow. Wow. This is total nightmare fuel. I know really nothing about this. This is terrible and fascinating. Yeah.
I mean, it's...
Wow.
Imagine you have, like, the first day that your kid walks to school alone. You had kind of an argument the night before, and then she's not coming home.
Mm-hmm.
How the mother must have felt. So horrible. So sad.
Yeah. One of my friends in grade school had a fight with her mother that morning. You know, when you're sort of in junior high and you're at that age where you just fight with your mother constantly about everything. It's like, if the sky is blue, you're going to fight about it. It's just mothers and daughters in that age. It's just life. But she had had an argument, just a normal argument about what she could wear or not wear to school, probably, you know, something silly.
Yeah.
And the principal came to the classroom door to get her. Her mother had died of an aneurysm, just a sudden.
Oh my God.
And she was so, you know, there's a reason that people say don't leave angry, right?
Yeah.
Not at the end of the day that it matters. I mean, obviously, she knew her mother loved her and her mother knew she loved, you know, there's none of that. But,
but still, it's so still, dramatic and it, so painful to go through.
Yeah.
And adds to the survivor's guilt.
Exactly. Exactly.
When we got married, everybody at the, we had this party afterwards when we returned from Miami and everybody was interviewed for a little video by our friends and for something they want to tell us to give us on our way into a married life. And my dad said, never leave the house or go to bed angry because you never know what's going to happen. And I always live by that.
It's absolutely good advice. My mom always said the same thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. And sometimes she'd come in at night and she'd say, I'm not very happy with you right now, but I love you very much. It was like, yeah, I love you too. And you're also the worst. See you later. You know, that's, but it's true. It's so important. You know,
it is.
It makes a difference. Wow.
All right. More about this next week.
Do you have something good this week?
You go first.
My something good is that I think Johanna's figured out. I think Johanna diagnosed Opus's occasional bizarre nighttime activities. So since we've had Opus, he has, most of the time, he sleeps in bed between us. And he's a very sweet boy, and there's no problem. And as he's getting older and more spatially aware of, like, how big he is and where his limbs are in the world, he's getting to be a better bed partner. But sometimes he does this thing where he gets up and he can't settle. He won't settle. He stands next to you and stares at you, or he'll put his head on your pillow with his nose almost touching yours and just breathe heavily on you until you open your eyes. And if that doesn't work, like if you've taken a muscle relaxant and you're really asleep, he'll sit on your head. So sometimes you wake up like, oh, I'm dying. This is how I'm gonna, and you're like, well, there's worse ways, right? Like if I'm gonna be crushed by a Great Dane, like let's face it, worse ways to go, right? But it's been going on for, well, forever. He'll be three at the end of the month and in a couple days. And so we just haven't been able to figure out what the cause of this is. And he always seems upset. He always seems like he wants comfort. Like he seems like he's scared or upset in some way. But we have not for the life of us been able to figure out what the cause is. And I sent a video to Johanna when he had done it twice to Paul. Paul had been up with him. So then I got up with him at like middle of the night, and I sent Johanna a video at like 4 a.m. and she immediately wrote me back and she was like, could it be acid reflux? And I was like, oh, it could be. Yeah, it could be. Actually, that makes a ton of sense. I think you've diagnosed the problem. And I think it gets worse. Like when Paul and I went away that one time, just the once to California, Moose was here and he loves Moose. He sat on Moose every night like a lunatic for the entire week we were gone. And I'm now guessing that the stress of us leaving, even though he loves Moose, probably made it worse.
Yeah.
So we've been giving him more food at bedtime because he's a picky eater and he doesn't eat his food when it's put in front of him. So we've been giving him a little extra food at night and fingers crossed, this is the problem that has been happening. And I should have realized it because there's been lots of other, but it's like there's been lots of other little things, but nothing that ever made perfect sense. So now it's like, oh, okay, I think we might figure out.
I only immediately said it because we had the exact same problem with Jem. Jem used to get up in the middle of the night and have acid reflux. And I didn't figure it out in the beginning as well. And then it was so bad that he even threw up, like this yellow.
The bile.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And That's when I realized, oh, I think he has acid reflux. And we started to give him like a little cookie in the middle of the night whenever he felt like this.
Yes.
And that stopped it completely. And the only reason why I immediately went for acid reflux was because of his smacking.
Lip smacking
he did. Yeah.
Well, and it's so funny because he does the lip smacking all the time. And part of it is where it's just his tongue gets stuck in funny places in his mouth. And so he's like the smackiest, the lips, like Tuck Tuck had some issues. Tucker came to us with a lot of fear aggression problems, right? And so one of the things you had to look for with Tuck, especially with strangers, was lip licking, because that's a number one sign that your dog is uncomfortable, right? Uncomfortable. If you have a dog that can be aggressive, look out for lip licking. And with Opus, nothing makes him uncomfortable, and he's constantly smacking because he just loses things up in that face. Mm. Like, there's always things caught in his jowls, and, like, he can't get his tongue back in the middle of his mouth again. It's kind of hilarious. But I missed it. I totally missed all the – so I think you've put it all together for us.
Yay. I hope so. I hope, because that's an easy thing to fix.
Yes, just making sure that he has had dinner before bed, like making sure he's got some food in that tummy. Yeah. How about you? Your garden looks beautiful.
Yeah, my something good is that the forsythias are in bloom and the primroses, and next up is going to be the tulips. They're going to open any day now. But the problem is the last 2 days we had like snow, like it was 6 degrees Celsius plus, sunshine, perfect weather in the morning. All of a sudden I look outside, it's a snowstorm. I'm like, what the fuck?
That's been this whole month.
Yeah, then wind chill, super cold. The next moment I look outside, it's sunshine. So I'm not sure. We had to fire the stove up again because, it got too cold in the house. But it's going to be fine. It's like this every year, and every year I'm pissed off, and every year I'm surprised that it's snowing in March, but it's going to be fine.
Yeah.
All my plants are going to survive, and that's my something good, my garden.
It's beautiful.
I love to walk through the garden in the morning and check all the new things that are blooming and check all the things that survived that I put in last year or 2 years ago. It's the best. I never liked plants, never liked flowers. I love it now. It's so calming and relaxing, and it puts your awareness of time into another perspective.
Yeah, I could see that, definitely. All right. If you enjoyed this episode or any of our episodes, we would be ever so grateful if you would leave us a rating or review. It means the world to us. It really does. It helps other people find us. And it's just the number one thing you can do to help the show without spending a penny. If you have any questions about how to find us, how to get in touch with us, please visit our webpage, which is freshhellpodcast.com. You can also go to Facebook and you can follow our page there. We also have a Facebook group, which is fantastic. It is just
the best.
The best, right?
Best group of weirdos out there.
Seriously, just the most interesting. It's wonderful. Our email address is freshhellpodcast@gmail.com. Also, we wanted to send a special shout out to our listener, Laura, who sent us, honestly, the most inspiring email that either of us have read in a very long time.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you so, so much for your incredibly kind words and taking the time to write. And we love you. Keep going. You're killing
you
it.
You have no idea how much that meant to us. It made me cry.
You made both of us cry. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Our merch, probably the easiest way to find our merch is just to go to our webpage, which is freshhellpodcast.com. And use the drop-down menu to go shop. I think that's probably the easiest way.
Yeah.
For Patreon, please remember for our murder tier patrons that our hangout is this Friday at night. The details are in the Patreon page. We will be chatting and probably picking your brains a little bit about what kind of decals you'd like going forward, that sort of stuff. But we're looking forward to catching up with you.
And that's it.
That's about it.
Yeah. Please tell your pets we said hi, all of them, the dogs, the cats, the guinea pigs, the geckos, the wallabies, the iguanas, the snakes, the rabbits, the donkeys, the geese, I don't know, the chickens, whatever floats your boat. Tell them we said hi, hug them, cuddle them, be kind to yourself. That's the hardest part of it all. And that's it.
Yeah. And if you yourself are going through hell,
keep going. Choose.
Bye.